I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. The automobile has played an important role in the development of this country, becoming a symbol of freedom, mobility, and a middle-class life. For African Americans, historically relegated to the back of the bus and segregated train cars, the automobile has had a unique and special significance. A driver's license and the interstate highway meant freedom from restrictive and discriminatory Jim Crow laws and the rewarding experiences that come with travel. The open road could also be dangerous for African Americans coming face to face with violence and discrimination. Our guest, Gretchen Zorn, writes about the history of African Americans and the automobile in her new book, Driving While Black, African American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. She also includes her own travel experiences as a young girl and the special precautions and preparations her parents had to take when they took to the road. Gretchen Zorn is Distinguished Professor, Director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program at the State University of New York at Oneonta. She's also an historical advisor on the Rick Burns documentary called Driving While Black that will be broadcast on PBS later this year. And Gretchen Zorn joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times. You're very welcome. I enjoyed this book because it's both history, which I think is important to talk about, but it's also your personal story as a girl growing up in Newark, New Jersey, whose dad loved to drive.
Well, you know, it's interesting to me. I didn't realize it was part of my personal story until I got well into the research. I started looking at the Green Book as a three-dimensional object that I wanted to include in an exhibition probably about 20 years ago,
wow,
before it was really popular. And a colleague from Bard College gave it to me, and she said, have you ever heard of this thing? And I said, no, I've never heard of it. And that's when I started digging into it.
A travel book specifically for African Americans.
Right, it was
telling
called,
them where you could stay, where you could eat.
Exactly, it was a little pamphlet. It was called the Negro Motorist Green Book, and it's now the popular book that everyone knows about because the movie, the Hollywood movie, The Green Book. So I started looking into the Negro Motorist Green Book just as an object for an exhibition, and as I got deeper and deeper into the story, I realized, wow, this is really my story. As well as the story of this publisher who created this travel guide.
In fact, you talk about taking a trip with your parents and I believe you have a brother, right?
Yes.
The four of you setting off going to Niagara Falls and the kind of planning and preparation that your parents had to have, not going south, but going north to make sure that they felt safe and their children were safe on the highway.
It's funny. My brother and I always thought our parents were a little peculiar. We would travel in the dark. We would get up in the wee hours of the morning. We would always have plenty of food in the car. They had one of those old green Coleman coolers, and
sure,
it would be full of food and brownies and beverages, and we would never stop. We never stopped the car. My grandmother, when she traveled with us, had a large old coffee can that she used as a pecan.
Wow.
And we thought that was the most disgusting thing we had ever seen. And she always carried that, insisted that my parents carry that in the car. So all of these peculiar habits, we never stayed at a hotel. We never stayed, we rarely went into a restaurant. And we thought those were strange habits. And then as I dug deeper into the research, I started to understand all of these peculiar habits.
You quote a historian who talks about, I think, going south, but the car is a kind of cocoon, and how his parents, or maybe just because they were so little, they couldn't see out the windows, but they couldn't see all the racist signage, KKK highways, things like that, as they traveled south.
And I think that was Spencer Crew. And
Spencer Crew
is actually now the director of the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., and a professor at George Mason in Virginia. And Spencer talked about, as he was talking to me, and the book is full of stories, and I did a lot of oral histories. As he was talking, I started to realize, well, that was really my experience as mm-hmm. well. Parents would buy these really large automobiles, big Buicks and large Ford station wagons and huge Oldsmobiles. And that was because you needed to carry a lot of stuff.
Wow.
You needed to carry food. You needed to carry blankets and pillows in case you needed to sleep in the car. you needed to carry my grandmother's pee can. You needed to. You might carry extra water for the radiator or an extra fan belt. So you bought a really large car so that you could carry stuff, and also so you could sleep in it if you needed to.
I mean, so we talk about America's love of cars, and it's, I think, clear when you certainly look at our history. But as I said in my introduction, for African Americans, it's a fraught history because, yes, there's the open road, but also the dangers that come with the open road.
I think it's really important to think about what the country was like before the automobile. Before the automobile, most people stayed put. You didn't go anywhere. Even though there were trains, most people stayed in their communities. They stayed in their neighborhoods. So white people generally stayed in white neighborhoods. Black people generally stayed in black neighborhoods. And yes, while there was interaction, and African-Americans often worked in service for white families, they generally retreated to their own neighborhoods in the evening. The automobile changes that.
Yeah.
The automobile makes it possible for people to go out on the road and to traverse white neighborhoods. So even if you're going from one safe black space, your black neighborhood, to another safe black space, say a black beach or a black resort, you have to traverse white neighborhoods to get there. And that could be very dangerous. And I think we don't really give the black middle class enough credit for the way that they were starting to open up the country just by going out and traveling.
The kind of courage, I guess,
exactly.
The courage of traveling the highway.
Because you had no idea what you might encounter. You had no idea if you would come across an angry mob or if you would come across people who were going to discriminate. It ranged from just humiliation to you could be murdered.
Talk about humiliation. You say one of the most humiliating thing was when there were segregated buses and black people were relegated to the back of the bus and the kind of humiliation that came with that. There were Jim Crow segregated cars, which tended to be dirty and crowded, but just the kind of humiliation of public transportation.
Exactly. And the even in the North, you would find Jim Crow cars because it was just easier for the conductor if you got in the Jim Crow car right off the bat rather than waiting until you got to D.C. So in D.C., you absolutely, if you were going south of the Mason-Dixon line, you had to be in the Jim Crow car.
Right.
But it was easier for the conductor if he didn't have to ask you to get up and move. And so even people who purchased first-class tickets because they could afford to purchase first-class tickets ended up often in the Jim Crow car.
And was it the conductor, the bus driver that had to enforce these racist laws and figure out who's black, who's white?
And they had total control. And there are so many instances, so many stories about bus drivers and conductors who really abused that control. Sometimes bus drivers carried guns.
Wow.
And if you refuse to sit in the back of the bus, you might get shot. There's one story about a black soldier and a white soldier sitting together. They were friends, and they wanted to sit together. And they were sitting together on a bus, and the bus driver says, "I'm sorry, but you can't sit together." And they said, "No, no, no. This is what we choose." And the bus driver says, "No, you can't sit together," and pulls out his gun to make sure. And the two have to go running to avoid being shot. But there are other instances of people actually being shot by bus drivers. And they did it because they could and because there were no ramifications if you did that.
Which makes Rosa Parks, you know, even more heroic than she actually is.
And there are dozens and dozens of stories before Rosa Parks even about people taking just deciding that they're not going to sit in the back of the bus.
So and maybe is this a middle class story? In many ways, a black middle class story?
It's a story about the black middle class, but one of the things that was really clear is that every African American who could afford a car bought a car. And the reason that so many African American families could buy a car was that as they had more and more disposable income, they were not able to purchase a house. And you couldn't purchase a house because your neighborhood was redlined and you couldn't get a mortgage. So if you can't buy a house, the next largest purchase is a car. And so many, many African Americans bought cars. And if you couldn't afford a new car, you bought a used car. And the car enabled you in many cases to get out of the South. It enabled you to go on vacation. It enabled you to just go, get out and go. And that was really important. If you think about mobility and you think about freedom, what is the most fundamental freedom, the freedom to go where you want to go, to be able, for all of us, that's really important. And for African Americans, that was denied for so many years that African Americans wanted to seize that freedom and get up and go.
You talk about the importance of a big car, not just to carry all those provisions because you couldn't stop along the road, but also, I guess, to look powerful on the road, but also to prevent things like breakdowns, because then, who knows, some stranger might, quote unquote, you know, try to help you, but end up beating you up.
African Americans wanted cars that were really reliable, cars that were large enough to carry all of their gear, right, and cars that would protect their families. They really saw the automobile as both a rolling living room, but also as a cocoon. And so, yes, they wanted these really large Buicks, large Oldsmobiles, and even Cadillacs.
Yeah.
What was so interesting is to look at the performers that purchased Cadillacs, and every one of them in their autobiographies had felt that they had to justify why they bought a Cadillac. They bought a Cadillac, Mahalia Jackson, Sammy Davis Jr. They bought a Cadillac because they could afford a Cadillac and they deserved to have a Cadillac if they wanted one. And the whole idea, the stereotype of African-Americans and Cadillacs is just that. It's a stereotype. African-Americans purchased Cadillacs in exactly the same percentage as white Americans, 3%. Very few. A small number of people that owned Cadillacs. But African Americans, again, could purchase Cadillacs because they were large cars, they were reliable cars, and also because, you know, if you could afford it, why not?
You do quote Mahalia Jackson, who had a Cadillac, and she describes, "There was no place for us to eat or sleep on the main highways. Restaurants wouldn't serve us. Teenage white girls who were serving as car hops would come bouncing out of the car and stop dead when they saw we were Negroes, spin around without a word and walk away." I mean, here's Mahalia Jackson, you know, obviously being denied a hamburger on the road.
And I think for all of these performers, it was acceptable to have black performers. And it was even desirable to have black performers, but then you wouldn't allow them to eat in the restaurant or to stay at the hotel. And often performers ended up having to drive late at night after their gig. So you'd perform in a city and then you had to get in a car and drive to the next city because there was no place for you to stay in the city or in the town. And that's one of the reasons there were so many automobile accidents.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Gretchen Soren about her new book. It's called Driving While Black, African-American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. You can join our conversation, that email address, I should say, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at phone number 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Oh, you know that every child
abroad,
running for Jesus,
like an automobile.
Yeah,
every child
abroad.
Like an automobile,
yeah.
Every child of God,
running for Jesus,
just like an automobile.
Prayer
is your driver's license.
Faith
is your steering.
Yeah. When you get on the road to glory, Satan is gonna try.
Christian Automobile by the Dixie Hummingbirds, recorded in 1957. Originally formed in Greenville, South Carolina, they relocated to Philadelphia in the 1940s. And our guest, Gretchen Soren, includes the Dixie Hummingbirds and this song in her new book, Driving While Black. You want to fill in the blanks there for us?
I love this song. It's so upbeat, and it compares Christianity to the freedom of the road and to the automobile, the importance of the automobile. And faith is your driver's license.
It works, right?
It works. It's a great song.
Well, you think of all the freedom riders, you know, the bus boycotts, how much of civil rights really was involved with transportation?
Transportation and religion, they were kind of interlinked in the civil rights movement. And music. And the Dixie Hummingbirds are a Philadelphia group.
We're happy about that. Here's an email from Esta. Our family traveled the same way, even though we had no green book. We slept in the car, had lots of food, a pecan, no hotels, gas only. I am Jewish and 72. You say an interesting thing in your book, which is the green book, which was for African Americans where they could find safe and welcoming places, drew to some extent on what Jews learned traveling the roads of America.
In the very first edition of the Negro Motorist Green Book, Victor Green says he was inspired. He got the idea from his Jewish brethren. Because when American Jews were traveling the country, they didn't have any places to stay as well if they were known to be Jewish. Since Jews enjoy white privilege, they can pass, or they could pass. But if you called a hotel and said, "My name is Schwartz," or "My name is Rubenstein," they would say, "Well, I'm sorry, but we've just rented our last room." So Jewish Americans really had to it was a hard time to travel as well. And Green, who is in Harlem, and of course there are Jews at the time,
sure,
living side by side in Harlem, got the idea for the Green Book. But he ended up having a bad travel experience, and he was looking for something.
This is Green?
Victor Green had a bad travel experience. He never tells us what that experience was.
Oh, interesting.
But he is inspired to do something about it and make sure he's not humiliated the way he was whenever that experience happened.
And the Green Book comes out in the 1930s.
It comes out in 1936, and it's published until 1966.
Wow. 30 years.
Yes. And it is not the only African-American travel guide. I think that's one of the things we have. Most people think, the Green Book was the travel guide. There were many, many travel guides. In fact, there were probably more than a dozen. Many of them had only one issue. Some of them have no extant issues. But there were also travel guides in African-American newspapers and in African-American magazines. So there were lots of ways that African Americans found out what places were safe to travel.
And what was the message of the Green Book or the sort of message or the mission of Green and his writers? What were they telling African American travelers?
The Green Book was first of all, it was very, very polite. And it was very, very middle class. And the language of the Green Book, I think it was written not only for African Americans, but it was written for white Americans.
Oh.
And it was incredibly temperate. He would say, he wouldn't say there anything about the racism encountered on the road. He would say, "Carry your Green Book with you. You might need it." And that message was very moderate for white Americans, but black Americans knew what he was talking about. It was kind of coded language. And I think that was because Green was able to get funding for his Green Book from Standard Oil. And
Esso, in the old Esso, days. Esso.
Exactly, from Esso. And Esso had been started by the Rockefeller family. And the Rockefellers were Baptists, and they were incredibly supportive of civil rights, founded Spelman College. And I think that they had enlightened self-interest. They knew, there's a market here, and we want to be the ones to get the Negro market to buy our gasoline. And so I think it was very prescient of them to say, okay, their policy was that they was non-discrimination at their Esso gasoline stations. And African Americans bought Esso gas in large numbers. Oh. African Americans chose gas of first choice was Esso, because you could use the restroom if you went to most Esso gas stations.
You include a couple of quotes from W.E.B. Du Bois, and one I underlined here where he talks about the Jim Crow system. He says, or he I guess he wrote, "The only discrimination that we chanced upon was one at which we heartily laughed. A filling station on the Jacksonville Daytona Road had a sign for white trade only. We passed it four times and saw no single car there. These crackers persist in being fools," says my companion.
Right. Here's this growing market. African Americans have more and more disposable income, growing black middle class, and they're a market that can purchase gasoline and tires and automobiles, and many white Americans didn't want to sell to them.
You also include something else, and it shows that W.B. had a good sense of humor.
He did.
I think. He says, "I remember once that the venerable Bishop Turner, stricken with paralysis, could for neither love nor money hire a Pullman berth from Savannah to Atlanta. They fixed the old man up in the Jim Crow smoker across two seats. Yesterday, I saw the AME Bishop of Florida. He was gliding along in his Cadillac car with a chauffeur on the way from Jacksonville to Atlanta. He looked extremely comfortable."
And that, you know, that is the reason you wanted your own car. Right. It made you comfortable and it made you happy, and you didn't have to deal with all that humiliation on the road.
On the other hand, you do include a lot of signs along the road that are just so overtly racist and, frankly, horrifying. And nonetheless, you know, there you are driving along the road and you see the KKK highway. You see worse than that.
And I think that was one of the reasons that it was so frightening to go out on the road, and it took so much courage. And it really that's what really made me understand how courageous my parents and everyone who just went out for a drive. There's even a story I talked to Valerie Cunningham, who's in who lived outside of Boston, and her father was terrified just driving around Boston because he felt it was such a racist place to be. Mm-hmm. And she says that he would always carry an old mason jar of water, mayonnaise jar of water, and he would start drinking water, and that's how she knew how nervous he was. But she was particularly nervous because her mother was very fair-skinned, and he was afraid that people would think he had a white woman in the car, and that would be trouble, even in Boston.
Did you, even in hindsight now, did you sense your parents' fear? As you said, your dad loved to drive, would go to Fayetteville, North Carolina, where there was family, obviously, you know, pretty deep into the South. Were you aware of their anxiety?
I was never aware. To tell you the truth, I was never aware as a child, neither my brother nor I. My father would never stay in North Carolina for very long. It was my mother's home, but we were always in the black neighborhood. We never encountered white folks except downtown in Fayetteville. And I do remember going downtown once to buy shoes for my young cousin for my grandmother's funeral. And this would have been in the 70s. And so when I think about it now, I think, incredible. In the 1970s, I was instructed to go and buy white shoes for my cousin because my aunt had told us, even though we were Episcopalian, that she was going to, we were all going to wear white in the funeral because that's what good Baptist children wore to funerals. And so I went downtown to buy these white shoes and didn't get waited on. And finally realized that other people were coming into the store and we weren't being waited on. And I left. I left the store.
These indignant. Were white customers who were being
white
waited
customers
on.
Were being waited on. And I left the store indignantly. And my aunt sent me back to get the shoes. And so that was my experience as a young girl from New Jersey. Trying to go to a store in the 1970s. So things didn't change immediately, obviously. And they changed very slowly. But the laws had changed. And that was a good thing.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Gretchen Soren, and we're talking about her new book. It's called Driving While Black, African American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. We got folks that are joining our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You do include some anecdotes about your family, and your dad was in the middle military.
Yes.
And was stationed in Fayetteville, North Carolina there, and had some bad experiences. I mean, this was, what, during World War II?
He was drafted. My father had grown up in New York City, and he was drafted in 1941. And that's how he ended up at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that's where he met my mother. And as I was digging into this research, I found out that my father had been at Fort Bragg when this terrible riot happened. And it was something I never knew and something he never mentioned. But it was quite spectacular. And an African-American soldier was riding back on a segregated bus. And he was just sick and tired of the segregation. The MPs were hitting black soldiers in the head as they wanted to do. These are all, you know, 20-year-old, 21-year-old young men. They got into an altercation. And young Ned Turner, who was a black soldier, pulled the gun out of the holster of the MP and shot him and killed him. And this is on this very crowded bus. And I looked up the weather. It was 97 degrees. It was August. It was humid in Fayetteville. It must have been an incredibly difficult to be stuffed into this bus with all of these other folks. And this melee occurs. The soldiers scatter. Seven people are injured. Ned Turner is killed by a white MP. So you have two men dead. And the Army, of course, is trying to do everything it can to make sure that there are good relations, good feelings in the Army, because this is World War II and we have to pull together as a nation. And so in order to suggest that they're doing everything they can, they pull a photographer and a reporter out from the black ranks, and they have them become the PR people for the improvements that they're doing at Fort Bragg. And so I'm flipping through the newspapers, and I see this photograph of the photographer and the reporter, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking, this man looks really familiar, and it's my young father. It's the youngest picture.
It's your own father.
It's my own father. The youngest picture I've ever seen of him, and he was the photographer.
And yet he never said a word.
And yet he never mentioned this. And there were multiple articles about he and the reporter in the black press. And they were there to report on the improvements that Fort Bragg was making. And one of the improvements was to bring young women from the historically black college, Fayetteville State, onto the base to play checkers with the soldiers and dance with the soldiers, keep everything calm, because there were no recreational facilities for black soldiers on base, which is what caused the problems in the first place. And so many black soldiers were drafted from the North, and then they go down to the South, and they're asked to fight Hitler, and they're Jim Crowed in yeah. the South. So it's a very, very difficult, volatile situation.
Indeed. Here's an email from Susan. During World War II, my father was at two Southern naval bases, and when the men went on leave, the black soldiers had to wait until there was a free seat at the back of the bus for them to go to town. If there was no empty seat, they had to wait until there was one. The hours would slip by while they waited and waited. Obviously, he never forgot the injustice of these poor guys watching their leave evaporate while they stood at the bus stop. Just to underscore what we're talking about.
And that happened not only at Fort Bragg, but at bases all over the South. Most of the military bases are in the Southern states. And there were riots, and there were lynchings all over the South.
So do you think it was in part returning soldiers, as you said, who were fighting Hitler, trying to liberate the world from fascism, coming home to America, and pushing against these discriminatory laws?
And that's also what helps to kickstart the civil rights movement. You know, this incredible injustice. We've just fought Hitler. We've just fought the war to end discrimination and racism. And you come back to the United States, and here are the Jim Crow laws still in place.
And maybe with some money, the GI Bill or other things, so that you have some money to to work your way into the middle class.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that my father was able to access. A lot of black soldiers couldn't access the GI Bill for whatever reason, but my parents were able to access that and to buy a house in New Jersey, and that's what got them started.
In fact, they had two cars.
They had two cars.
I mean, that's the sure sign of a middle-class life,
right? It sure is.
A comment from Lee, I've been driving down south a lot lately, and whenever I pass a slow driver, I notice when they're black. And it makes me think about how the consequences are so much higher for black drivers if they get pulled over by the police. It's a fear I won't be able to understand as a white person. It is so unfair.
There were a lot of rules, unwritten rules, that African Americans followed, and driving as slowly as you could was one of them. Driving under the speed limit was so important, because if you were even 1 mile over the speed limit, you might get pulled over and you might get an incredibly heavy fine, or you might end up in jail. And that's one place you didn't want to end up, was in a southern jail. Yeah. And so you drove under the speed limit.
And you had to be careful not to break down.
You had to be absolutely careful not to break down, because if you broke down, particularly in a white neighborhood, the police would show up immediately, and they were not concerned. They were not at all concerned about your car. They were concerned with getting you out of the neighborhood.
Mm.
And that's a story, actually, that Lonnie Bunch, who's now the secretary of the Smithsonian, tells. He tells a story of being with his father, and their car breaks down. He's a young boy. And they're in a white neighborhood, and he said immediately, the police showed up immediately, and they didn't care about the car. All they wanted to do was, you know, get them out of the neighborhood.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Gretchen Soren about her new book. It's titled Driving While Black African American Travel and the Road to Civil Rights. She's a distinguished professor, also director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program of the State University of New York in Oneonta, and she is a historical advisor on an upcoming documentary by Rick Burns called, yes, Driving While Black. It'll be broadcast later this year on public television, and I'm sure here at WHYY. You can join our conversation. We want your stories, your comments, your questions. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You've heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Rocket 88, recorded in 1951 by Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats and Ike Turner and his King of Rhythms. It's about the Oldsmobile Rocket 88, which had recently been introduced, and some consider it the first rock and roll song. We play that because our guest writes in her new book about Medgar Evers. This was the car that he chose, in part because it was big. But as you write, Gretchen Soren, when you press the accelerator, the Olds took off and could outrun an ambush.
Medgar Evers was responsible for driving all over the state of Mississippi as the secretary for the NAACP. And he got himself into some hot water. He was visiting sites of church burnings, sites of lynchings, and it was a very dangerous job in those days. And he chose the Rocket 88 because it was fast.
Wow.
And because
big.
And big. Well, he was over 6 feet tall, and he knew that he might have to sleep in the car. So that was one thing. It had those long bank seats, so you could sleep on the front seat or the back seat, and it really responded. The accelerator really responded. It had a powerful engine.
We've talked a little bit about some of the signs down south, and can you talk about them? I mean, what literally, if black drivers driving in the south, the kinds of signs that they would see on the road?
I think there were often welcome to Klan country signs where the Klan was strong. There were also signs that let you know that you weren't welcome, that beaches were segregated, phone booths were segregated. There were signs that, white-only phone booths. There were signs for, obviously, in restaurants and in hotels that said white-only. I think the scariest signs were the sundown town signs that said, nigger, be out of this town by sundown.
And that was a sign.
And that was a sign. And those signs, even though African-Americans could work in those communities, they could work as gardeners or chauffeurs or maids, they had to be out of town by sundown. There was even one community that had a siren that went off at 6 o'clock to let black people know that they needed to be out of town by sundown. And there's a great story in the book about Thurgood Marshall, who is standing on the train platform waiting to leave one town. And this is when he is the lawyer for the NAACP, before he becomes a Supreme Court justice. And he recounts the story of standing on this train platform, and a man comes up to him and says, "Nigger boy, what are you doing here? What are you doing in this town?" And he says, "I'm waiting for the train to Shreveport." And the man says to him, "Well, you better be on that train, because no nigger has ever been alive after sundown in this town." And that was, we think of sundown towns as being only in the South. Many, many sundown towns were in the West. And even Darien, Connecticut was a sundown town. So Sheboygan was a sundown town. There were hundreds of sundown towns all over this country. When you think about African Americans traveling, you had to go through many of these communities in order to get to your destination.
So the car is both this road to, put you on the road to freedom, but it also puts you on the road to danger.
To danger, and that's the irony. That's the irony of the automobile.
Greenville, is that South or North Carolina? I'm showing my ignorance.
It's Greenville, Texas.
Oh, Greenville, Texas. Mm-hmm. The banner read, "The blackest land, the whitest people."
And there's a young lawyer that talks about going through Greenville, Texas multiple times when she was a kid and how frightening that sign was to her. And she says she had no idea what could happen in a town that put that banner across the main street. And it was also on the water tower. The same words were on the water tower of the town.
So certain laws passed in the, 60s?
1964, civil rights.
Civil rights.
This is after, generations of African-Americans have advocated for this law. And this is after Johnson passes a civil rights legislation. And public accommodations open up overnight, or supposedly are opened up overnight. There are several challenges to the law which are not successful.
Right.
And now African-Americans can stay at the Hilton or the Sheraton or any other large chain hotel, and that's something that they've worked to be able to do. The NAACP has sued large chains, I think beginning with Hilton and Howard Johnson's, to open up those large chain hotels.
How about stopping on the road? Is it not as dangerous as it was maybe 50 years ago, but still concerns?
Do you mean today?
Yeah.
I think African Americans are still wary. I think African Americans are still frightened and look for friendly faces when they're traveling. I do think we've come a very long way, and certainly you don't have any fear of calling hotels or stopping at restaurants. But I do think there are many places in this country that African Americans are still afraid to go.
Well, driving while black, I mean, means so many different things. And in current day parlance, it's, you know, concerns about being pulled over by the police. And, you know, you make a quick move and you could be in serious trouble.
And I think there actually is some research that shows that African Americans are pulled over at a far greater rate than white Americans. And if the police see that you're African American, you're much more likely to get pulled over. So I think African Americans are terribly frightened of the police. I think there's a long history of discrimination. And of course, that makes sense. So many of the police in the South were part of the Klan and were supporting the Klan. And so African Americans are very frightened of the police.
Will you even include, you know, the conversation you had with your son Gregory at the end of the book about he turned 16, he's going to start driving a car. What did you tell him?
We live in a very rural area where there aren't a lot of African Americans. And my son would often be in a car with a bunch of other teenagers, many of them white, and I was terrified to have him encounter not so much the state troopers in New York, but the local police departments. And you know, I told him, "You've got to keep your hands on the wheel. Don't move. Don't make any southern moves. Turn the light on in the car. Don't reach for your cell phone. Don't reach for anything." Be very polite to the police officer. You don't want to do anything to antagonize a sheriff or any of the local police.
You're right. I'm afraid of the police. I admit it. This doesn't mean that I am anti-police or that I believe that all policemen and police women are anti-black. It means that as an African-American woman and a historian familiar with the history of this relationship between African-Americans and law enforcement, I don't want to encounter that policeman who will be terrified of me or one of my family members or who may be a racist bent on killing black people because they know they will get away with it.
Exactly.
And I mean, this is today, right?
That's today. That's exactly. And I think if we look at some of the recent cases, Philando Castile, for example, who is just sitting in his car with his girlfriend and a baby, and the person who shot him was just terrified. One of the things that I did was to interview the commander of police in Montreal, Sylvain Bissonnette, who's a French speaker. And what he told me was absolutely fascinating. And his view of the police is that largely their job is to be problem solvers. And a little bit of their job is law enforcement. Mm. And if you're a problem solver, then you're thinking about how do I fix this? How do I diffuse the situation rather than escalate the situation? And I thought he had some very interesting things to say. They never, in Montreal, they never carry their guns outside of the police station. They lock up their guns in the police station. So if he's sitting in a bar as an off-duty policeman, he doesn't have a gun. And I thought, wow, I think that's kind of an interesting approach. He also told me about there was some problem with Hasidic Jews in Montreal. And when it gets dark on Shabbos, they'll just get out of their cars and walk away and leave their car right in the middle of the street if sundown happens to come. And so he will say to his officers, don't tow the car, don't arrest the man, don't what you do is you just get in the car, they'll leave the keys in the car, just get in the car and pull it to the side of the road. You've solved a problem. And you don't have to the man doesn't have to go through all of the bureaucratic nonsense that you have to go through to get your car back. He also doesn't have to go through the court system. You've saved the city a lot of money and you've solved a problem, and it didn't become a law enforcement problem. It was just solving a community problem and helping out someone who was adhering to their religion. And I thought that was kind of an interesting idea. Yeah. If policemen thought of themselves as problem solvers rather than law enforcers.
Let me ask you a couple more questions related to your book. So what kind of cars did your dad enjoy? What did he have a certain – was he a Cadillac man? Was he an Oldsmobile man?
No, we had a Studebaker. Huh? And that's the car that looks like an airplane in the front. And Fords, Ford station wagons, those ones with the fake wood on the side.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
Yes, yes, those carried a lot. Those carried a lot of stuff.
You also talk about not going to national parks. That was not necessarily going to be on an itinerary. Why not?
And you know, it's still true. African Americans do not go to the national parks in large numbers. The national parks. Well, first of all, they were in the West, and there were a lot fewer places that you could stay at the national parks in the West. Secondly, they were in the woods. And African Americans were not fond of going into the woods. You didn't know who you might encounter in the woods. There are lots of trees in the woods. Ropes hang from trees. And there were many people that would say, well, you know, I wasn't that interested in going into the woods, and I might encounter, you know, some white people that would be some scary folks. And so the national parks don't become popular spots for African Americans, even though, you know, Ebony runs a couple of articles saying, you know, come to the national parks, they're wonderful places. And some people do go there. But one of the things I think is very clear is that the national parks were segregated. You could go to the national parks. You could get into the national parks for free. They were open. There was a national policy of non-segregation, non-discrimination. However, the concessions, the hotels, the cabins, the restaurants, those were all operated by private interests, and they were segregated. So you might get all the way out to Grand Teton National Park or the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone and find that you were staying at a segregated cabin, and it was filthy.
And it was filthy on top of it. Mm-hmm. Your dad would carry a gun, right?
My father worked with the police, and he trained officers, and he had a permit to carry a rifle. And whenever we went camping or did something in a rural area, that rifle was in the car. And I just assumed it was that he wanted to do some target practice. But now I think, maybe there was another reason he had that rifle. It was in a bag, you know. It was in a bag, but he always carried that rifle.
You also say that, and this is when the travel was so segregated, that oftentimes it was women who would open their homes to travelers.
That was a way for women to make extra money. And I think it was really kind of smart. If you had an extra bedroom or two, you could open your home and you could make it available to any travelers. And those, often in the Negro Motors Green Book, it listed, you know, Mrs. George Smith or Mrs. John Jones had a room or two to rent.
So it was kind of word of mouth, I guess.
Well, they were in the Green Book.
Yes.
But it was a lot of travel spots were word of mouth. And the Negro Motors Green Book was also operated by women. Victor Green dies in 1960. And when he dies, Alma Green, his wife, steps up, and she becomes the publisher. Even though he continues to be the public face of the publication, Alma Green and four women, three black women and one white woman, are the publishers. And this is 1960, and it was unheard of to have a woman-owned publishing company in those days. This was really, really unusual, and she was amazing.
And these were women writers that would go out and essentially check out restaurants and hotels to...
These were women writers that did that. And they also managed a mail campaign that would find places across the country. Because as you got further and further from New York City, it was harder and harder to find those places. And the Green Book becomes national and then international. So they did it by mail, and they also had agents in different parts of the country that kind of scoped out places for them.
Well, we have to leave it there. Gretchen Soren, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Distinguished professor and director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program of the State University of New York and Oneonta, author of this book we've been talking about, Driving While Black, African-American Travel on the Road to Civil Rights. And she's an advisor on Rick Burns' documentary that should be out in the fall, Driving While Black. It'll be broadcast on PBS and I'm sure here at WHYY. And our guest is speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.